"'Such a long time,' said the duck on the nest. "'It won't crack open. "'But take a look at the others. "'They're the loveliest ducklings I've ever seen. "'They all look like their father, "'that rogue who never comes to see me.' "'Let me look at the egg that won't crack open,' said the old duck. "'I'll bet it's a turkey egg. "'I was once fooled like that myself, "'and I had my share of troubles with those youngsters "'because they're afraid of the water, let me tell you. "'I couldn't get them to go in. "'I quacked and snapped, but it did no good. "'Let me see that egg. "'It's a turkey egg, all right. "'Just leave it here and go teach the other children to swim.' "'I think I'll sit on it for a little while longer,' said the duck. "'I've been sitting here this long. "'I might as well sit here the rest of the summer.' "'Be my guest,' said the old duck. And then she left. Finally, the big egg cracked open. "'Peep, peep,' said the youngster and tumbled out. He was so big and hideous. The duck looked at him. "'That's certainly an awfully big duckling,' she said. "'None of the others look like that. "'He couldn't be a turkey chick, could he? "'Well, we shall soon see. "'Into the water he goes, even if I have to kick him in myself.' "'The next day the weather was gloriously beautiful. "'The sun shone on all the green dock plants. "'The mother duck and her whole family went down to the moat. "'Splash! She jumped into the water. "'Quack, quack!' she said, "'and one duckling after the other plopped in.' The water washed over their heads, but they popped up at once and floated around so beautifully. Their legs moved on their own, and all of them were in the water. Even the hideous grey youngster was swimming along. "'No, he's not a turkey,' she said. "'Look how beautifully he uses his legs, how erect he holds himself. That's my child. Actually, he's quite handsome, if you take a good look. Quack, quack. Come along with me.' "'And I'll take you out into the world and introduce you to the duckyard. "'But stay close to me so that no one steps on you, and watch out for the cats.'
"'And then they went into the duckyard. "'There was a terrible ruckus going on because two families were fighting over an eel head, "'and then the cat ended up getting it.
"'See, that's how things go in the world,' said the mother duck, licking her bill,
"'because she too would have liked to have that eel head.
"'Use your legs now,' she said. "'See if you can't hurry it up, and dip your necks to the old duck over there. "'She's the most refined of anyone here. "'She has Spanish blood, that's why she's so fat. "'And see there, she has a red rag around her leg. "'That's a remarkably lovely thing, and the highest honour any duck can be given. "'She's so important that they won't get rid of her, "'and both animals and humans must respect her. "'Hurry up, don't put your legs together.' A well-mannered duckling keeps his legs far apart, just like father and mother. Come on. Now dip your neck and say, quack.
And that's what they did. But the other ducks standing around looked at them and said quite loudly,
Look at this! Now we've got to deal with that bunch too. As if there weren't enough of us already. And ugh, just take a look at that duckling. We're not going to put up with him.
And one of the ducks flew over and promptly bit him on the back of the neck.
"'Leave him alone,' said the mother. "'He's not hurting anyone.' "'Yes, but he's too big and too odd-looking,' said the duck who had bitten him. "'So he's going to be pushed around.' "'What handsome children that mother has,' said the old duck with the rag around her leg. "'All of them so handsome, except for one. "'That one certainly didn't turn out too well.' I wish she could hatch that one over again.
That's not possible, Your Grace, said the mother duck. He may not be handsome, but he has a genuinely good nature, and he swims as beautifully as any of the others. Yes, I'd venture to say even a little better. I think he'll be handsome when he grows up, or with time he might get a little smaller. He was too long in the egg, and that's why he isn't the right shape.
Then she plucked at the back of his neck and smoothed out his feathers.
"'Besides, he's a drake,' she said, "'so it doesn't matter as much. "'I think he'll turn out to be strong, "'and I'm sure he'll win a place for himself.' "'The other ducklings are so charming,' said the old duck. "'Make yourselves at home, and if you happen to find an eel head, "'you can bring it to me.'
"'And so they made themselves at home. But the poor duckling, who was the last to come out of his egg, and looked so horrid, was bitten, shoved, and teased by both the ducks and the hens. "He's too big," they all said. And the tom turkey, who was born with spurs, which made him think he was an emperor, puffed himself up like a ship at full sail, walked right over to him, and started gobbling until he turned bright red in the face. The poor duckling had no idea which way to turn. He was very sad, because he looked so hideous, and was ridiculed by the whole duck yard. That's how it went on the first day, and afterward it got worse and worse. The poor duckling was chased by everyone. Even his siblings were mean to him, and they always said, "If only the cat would get you, what a horrid troublemaker you are!" And his mother said, "If only you were far away!" The ducks bit him, and the hens pecked at him, and the maid who was supposed to feed the animals gave him a kick with her foot. Then he took off running and flew over the hedge. The little birds in the bushes darted up into the air out of fright. "It's because I'm so hideous," thought the duckling, and closed his eyes, but still kept on running. Then he reached the great marsh where the wild ducks lived. There he lay all night. He was so tired and sad. In the morning the wild ducks flew up, and they looked at their new companion. "Who on earth are you?" they asked, and the duckling turned this way and that, greeting them as best he could. "You're awfully hideous," said the wild ducks. "But that doesn't matter to us, provided you don't marry anyone in our family." The poor thing. He had no intention of getting married, as long as he was allowed to sit among the reeds and drink a little marsh water. There he stayed for 2 whole days. Then 2 wild geese came along, or rather 2 wild ganders, because they were males. It wasn't long ago that they had come out of their eggs, and that's why they were so brash. "Listen here, my friend," they said. "You're so hideous that we actually like you. Want to come along and be a migrating bird? Nearby in another marsh there are some heavenly sweet wild geese, all of them young ladies who could say quack. You're in a position to be a success because you're so hideous." Bang! Boom! They suddenly heard overhead. Both the wild geese fell dead into the reeds, and the water turned blood red. Bang! Boom! Was heard again, and entire flocks of wild geese rose up from the reeds. Then shots rang out again. A great hunt was underway. The hunters lay all around the marsh. Some were even up in the tree branches that stretched far out over the reeds. Blue smoke drifted like clouds among the dark trees and hovered far out over the water. Through the mud came the hunting dogs. Splash, splash! Reeds and rushes swayed on all sides. What a horror it was for the poor duckling! He turned his head to tuck it under his wing. But just at that moment a huge, terrifying dog stopped right next to him, his long tongue hanging out of his mouth and his eyes shining horridly. He lowered his jaws toward the duckling, showed his sharp teeth, and splish, splish! He left without taking him. "Oh, thank God," sighed the duckling. "I'm so hideous that not even the dog wanted to bite me." And he lay very still as the bullets whistled through the reeds, with one shot exploding after the other. Not until late in the day was it quiet, but the poor youngster still didn't dare stand up. He waited another few hours before he looked around, and then hurried away from the marsh as fast as he could, racing over field and meadow. There was a strong wind, so he had a hard time making headway. Toward evening he reached a poor little farmhouse. It was so wretched that it couldn't make up its mind which way to fall, and that's why it was still standing. The wind was blowing so hard against the duckling that he had to sit on his tail to hold his ground, and it got worse and worse. Then he noticed that the door had come loose from one of its hinges, and was hanging so crookedly that he could slip through the crack into the house, and that's what he did. Inside lived an old woman with her cat and her hen. The cat, who was called Sunny, could arch his back and purr. He could even throw off sparks, but for that you had to stroke his fur the wrong way. The hen had very short little legs, and that's why she was called Henny Shortlegs. She was good at laying eggs, and the woman was as fond of her as her own child. In the morning they noticed at once the strange duckling. The cat started purring, and the hen began to cluck. "What's this?" said the woman, looking all around, but she couldn't see well, and that's why she thought the duckling was a plump duck that had gone astray.
"What a nice find!" she said. "Now I can have duck eggs, if only it's not a drake. We'll have to give it a try."
And so the duckling was accepted on a trial basis for 3 weeks, but no eggs appeared. The cat was master of the house, and the hen was the mistress. They both kept on saying, "We and the rest of the world," because they thought they were half of it, and the better half at that. The duckling thought it might be possible to have another opinion, but the hen wouldn't stand for it.
"Can you lay eggs?" she asked.
"No."
"Well, then, you'd better keep your mouth shut."
And the cat said,
"Can you arch your back, purr, and throw sparks?"
"No."
"Well, then, we don't want to hear from you when sensible people are talking."
And the duckling sat in the corner in a bad temper. Then he happened to think about the fresh air and sunshine. He had such a strange desire to float on the water that at last he couldn't resist. He had to tell the hen.
"What's come over you?" she asked. "You don't have anything to do. That's why you get such ideas into your head. Lay eggs, or purr, and it will pass."
"But it's so lovely to float on the water," said the duckling. "So lovely to dip your head under water and dive down to the bottom."
"Oh, that's a great pleasure, all right," said the hen. "You must be crazy. Ask the cat, and he's the smartest one I know, whether he likes floating on the water or diving underneath. I won't even talk about myself. Or you can ask our mistress, the old woman. There's no one wiser than her in the whole world. Do you think she wants to float and get water on her head?"
"You don't understand me," said the duckling.
"Well, if we don't understand you, then who does? You'll never be smarter than the cat or the old woman, not to mention myself. Stop making a fuss, child, and thank your Creator for all the kindness that has been shown to you. Haven't you ended up in a warm house, with companions that you can learn something from? But you're a fool, and it's not amusing to be around you. Believe me, it's for your own good that I'm telling you these unpleasant things. That's how you know who your true friends are. So see to it that you lay eggs, and learn to purr, and throw sparks."
"I think I'll go out into the wide world," said the duckling.
"Well, go ahead," said the hen.
And so the duckling left. He floated on the water, then dove down, but all the animals ignored him because he was ugly. Then autumn came. The leaves in the forest turned brown and yellow. The wind seized hold of them so they danced around, and the sky looked cold. The clouds hung heavy with hail and snowflakes, and on the fence stood a raven shrieking, "Ow! Ow!" from sheer cold. Yes, you could end up freezing just by thinking about it. Things certainly weren't going well for the poor duckling. One evening, as the sun was setting gloriously, a whole flock of lovely big birds came out of the thickets. The duckling had never seen anything so beautiful. They were a dazzling white with long, supple necks. They were swans. They uttered quite a wondrous sound, spread out their magnificent long wings, and flew away from the cold regions to the warmer countries, to open waters. They climbed so high, and the little ugly duckling felt quite strange. He spun around in the water like a wheel, stretching his neck high up into the air after them, uttering a cry so loud and strange that it scared even him. Oh, he couldn't forget those lovely birds, those happy birds. As soon as he lost sight of them, he dove straight down to the bottom, and when he came back up, he was practically beside himself. He didn't know what those birds were called or where they were flying, but he loved them as he had never loved anyone else. He didn't envy them in the least. How could he even think of wishing for such loveliness? He would have been happy if the ducks had merely allowed him to stay among them. The poor, ugly creature. And the winter was so cold. So cold! The duckling had to swim around in the water to keep it from freezing over. But every night the hole in which he was swimming grew smaller and smaller. It froze so hard that the icy crust crackled. The duckling had to keep moving his legs or the water would close up. At last he grew so weak that he lay quite still and then was frozen into the ice. Early in the morning a farmer appeared. He saw the duckling, went out, smashed the ice to bits with his wooden clog, and carried the bird home to his wife. There the duckling was revived. The children wanted to play with him, but the duckling thought they were trying to hurt him and flew in terror right into the milk basin, so the milk splashed all over the room. The farmer's wife screamed and flapped her hands in the air. Then the duckling flew into the trough of butter, and then into the flour barrel, and out again. What a sight he was! The farmer's wife screamed and swung at him with the hearth tongs, and the children tumbled all over each other to catch the duckling as they laughed and shrieked. It was a good thing that the door stood open. Out he rushed into the bushes in the newly fallen snow. There he lay, as if in a daze. But it would be much too sad to recount all the suffering and misery he had to endure that harsh winter. He was lying in the marsh, among the rushes, when the sunshine once again began to feel warm. The larks sang. It was lovely springtime. Then all of a sudden he lifted his wings. They flapped stronger than before, and powerfully carried him away. And before he even knew it, he was in a great garden where the apple trees stood in bloom, where the lilacs hung fragrantly on their long green boughs all the way down to the winding waterways. Oh, it was so lovely there, so springtime fresh. And right in front of him, out of the thickets, came three lovely white swans. They ruffled their feathers and floated so lightly on the water. The duckling recognized the magnificent creatures and was stirred by a strange sadness. "I'll fly over to them, those royal birds, and they'll peck me to death, because someone like me, who is so hideous, dares approach them. But it doesn't matter. Better to be killed by them than to be nipped by the ducks, pecked by the hens, kicked by the maid who tends the chicken coops, and to suffer so terribly all winter." And he flew out into the water and swam over to the magnificent swans. They saw him, and came gliding toward him with ruffled feathers. "Go ahead and kill me," said the poor bird, and he bent his head down to the surface of the water and waited for death. But what did he see in the clear water? He saw beneath him his own image, and he was no longer a clumsy, greyish-black bird, horrid and hideous. He was a swan. It doesn't matter if you're born in a duckyard, when you've been lying inside a swan's egg. He actually felt glad about all the suffering and hardships he had endured. Now he could appreciate his happiness and all the loveliness that awaited him, and the great swans swam all around him, stroking him with their bills. Several little children came into the garden. They threw bread and grain into the water, and the youngest of them cried, "There's a new one!" And the other children also shouted joyfully, "Yes, a new one has arrived!" And they clapped their hands and danced around. They ran to find father and mother. Bread and cakes were tossed into the water, and they all said, "The new one is the most beautiful of all, so young and so lovely." And the old swans bowed to him. Then he felt quite bashful, and tucked his head behind his wings. He didn't know what to make of it. He was much too happy, but not the least bit proud, because a good heart is never proud. He thought about how he had been badgered and scorned, and now he heard everyone say that he was the loveliest of all the lovely birds. The lilacs dipped their boughs all the way down to him in the water, and the sun shone so warm and so fine. Then he ruffled his feathers, raised his slender neck, and rejoiced with all his heart. "I never dreamed of so much happiness when I was the ugly duckling."
End of Disc 4.
The Fir Tree. Out in the forest stood such a charming fir tree. It was in a good spot where it could get sunshine and there was plenty of air. All around grew scores of bigger companions, both firs and pines, but the little fir tree was so eager to grow up that it didn't think about the warm sun or the fresh air. It didn't pay any attention to the farm children who walked past chattering whenever they were out gathering strawberries or raspberries. Often they would come by with a whole pitcher full, or they would have strawberries threaded on a piece of straw. Then they would sit down near the little tree and say, "Oh, how charming and little it is!" That's not at all what the tree wanted to hear. The following year it was a full length taller, and the year after that, yet another. On a fir tree you can always tell how many years it has been growing by how many layers of branches it has.
"Oh, if only I were a big tree like the others," sighed the little tree. "Then I could spread out my branches all around, and from the top I could gaze out on the wide world. The birds would build nests in my branches, and when the wind blew I could nod so grandly like all the others."
The tree took no pleasure in the sunshine, in the birds, or in the crimson clouds that sailed overhead both morning and evening. When it was winter and the snow lay all around, glittering white, a hare often came bounding along and sprang right over the little tree. Oh, how annoying that was! But two winters passed, and by the third the tree was so tall that the hare had to go around it.
"Oh, to grow and grow, to get bigger and older, that is the only lovely thing in this world," thought the tree.
In the autumn, the woodcutters would always appear to chop down some of the biggest trees. It happened every year, and the young fir tree, which was now quite grown up, would start trembling because the tall, magnificent trees would topple to the ground with a groan and a crash. Their branches would be cut off, and they looked so naked, tall and slender. They were almost beyond recognition. But then they were loaded onto wagons, and horses carried them away out of the forest. Where were they going? What was in store for them? In the spring, when the swallow and stork appeared, the tree asked them,
"Do you know where they were taken? Have you seen them?"
The swallows didn't know anything, but the stork looked thoughtful, nodded his head, and said,
"Oh, yes, I think so. I met many new ships as I flew here from Egypt. On the ships were magnificent mast trees, and I'd venture to say they were yours. They smelled of fir. I bring you many greetings. How they swaggered and swayed. Oh, if only I too were big enough to fly across the sea. What is the sea like, anyway? How does it look?"
"Well, it's much too complicated to describe," said the stork, and flew off.
"Enjoy your youth," said the rays of sunlight. "Enjoy your fresh growth and the young life inside you."
The wind kissed the tree, and the dew shed tears over it, but the fir tree did not understand. When Christmas time came, quite young trees were felled, trees that were often not even as tall or as old as the fir tree, which could never find any peace but was always eager to be off. These young trees, and they were the most beautiful of all, always kept their branches. They were loaded onto wagons, and horses carried them away out of the forest.
"Where are they going?" asked the fir tree. "They're no bigger than I am. There was even one that was much smaller. Why do they keep all their branches? Where are they being taken?"
"We know, we know," chirped the sparrows. "In town, we've looked in the windows. We know where they're being taken. Oh, they end up in the greatest splendour and glory you could ever imagine. We've looked in the windows and seen them being planted in the middle of the warm parlour and decorated with the loveliest things, gilded apples, gingerbread, toys, and hundreds of candles."
"And then?" asked the fir tree, all its branches a-quiver. "And then? What happens next?"
"Well, that's all we saw, but nothing could match it."
"Maybe I was meant to take this glorious path," rejoiced the fir tree. "That's even better than going across the sea. What an agony of longing! If only it were Christmas! Now I'm as tall and broad as the others that were carried off last year. Oh, if only I were on that wagon right now! If only I were in the warm parlour with all that splendour and glory! And then, well, then something even better is bound to happen. Something even more wonderful, or why would they decorate me like that? Something even grander, even more glorious is bound to happen. But what? Oh, how I'm suffering! Oh, how I yearn! I just don't know what's come over me."
"Take pleasure in us," said the air and the sunlight. "Take pleasure in your fresh youth out in the open." But the fir tree felt no pleasure at all. It grew and grew. Both winter and summer it was green, dark green it stood there. Everyone who saw it said, "That's a lovely tree." And at Christmas it was the very first to be cut down. The axe bit deep into its marrow, and the tree fell to the ground with a sigh. It felt a pain, a weakness. It couldn't even think about happiness. It was sad to part with its home, with the spot where it had sprouted up, for the tree realized that it would never see its dear old companions again, the small shrubs and flowers all around, maybe not even the birds. Leaving was certainly not pleasant. The tree didn't recover until it was unloaded in a courtyard with all the other trees, and it heard a man say, "That one is magnificent! That's the one we want!" Then two servants in fine livery came and carried the fir tree into an enormous, beautiful room. Portraits hung on all the walls, and next to the large wood stove stood big Chinese vases with lions on the lids. There were rocking chairs, silk-covered sofas, big tables covered with picture books, and toys worth 100 times 100 Riksdaler. At least, that's what the children said. And the fir tree was set in a large wooden tub filled with sand. But no one could tell that it was a wooden tub because green fabric was wrapped all around it, and the tub stood on top of a big, colourful carpet. Oh, how the tree trembled! What was going to happen next? Then the servants and the maids proceeded to decorate the tree. On one branch they hung little woven baskets cut out of coloured paper. Each basket was filled with sweets. Gilded apples and walnuts hung on the tree as if they had grown there, and more than 100 little candles, red and blue and white, were fastened to the branches. Dolls that looked as lifelike as human beings swayed in the boughs. The tree had never seen anything like it before, and at the very top they put a big star made from shiny gold paper. It was magnificent, quite incomparably magnificent. "Tonight," they all said, "tonight the tree will shine." "Oh," thought the tree, "if only it were evening. If only they'd light the candle soon. And what will happen after that? Will trees come from the forest to look at me? Will the sparrows fly past the window? Will I take root and stand here decorated like this all winter and summer long?" Oh, yes, the tree thought it knew all about it. But it had a terrible bark ache from sheer yearning, and bark aches are just as bad for trees as headaches are for the rest of us. Finally the candles were lit. What splendour! What magnificence! Every branch of the tree trembled so much that one of the candles set fire to a bough. How it stung! "God help us!" shrieked the maids, and hastily put out the fire. Now the tree didn't even dare tremble. Oh, how awful! It was so afraid of losing any of its finery. It was quite bedazzled by all the splendour. And when the double doors flew open, and a crowd of children rushed in, as if they were about to topple the whole tree, the grown-ups followed more sedately. The children stood in utter silence, but only for a moment. Then they began shouting again, so their voices echoed through the room. They danced around the tree, and one present after the other was plucked from the branches. "What are they doing?" thought the tree. "What's going to happen?" And the candles burned all the way down to the boughs, and as they burned down they were put out. And then the children were allowed to plunder the tree. Oh, how they rushed at it, making all the branches groan! If the tree hadn't been tied to the ceiling by its top and the gold star, it would have toppled right over. The children danced around with their splendid toys. No one paid any attention to the tree except for the old nursemaid who walked around it, peering in among the branches. But she was only checking to see that not a fig or apple had been overlooked. "A story! A story!" shouted the children, pulling a stout little man over to the tree. And he sat right down underneath it.
"Because we're out in the forest," he told them, "and it may do the tree some good to listen along. But I'm only going to tell you one story. Do you want to hear the one about Ickety-Ackety, or the one about Clumper-Dumper, who fell down the stairs, but still ended up on the throne and won the hand of the princess?"
"Ickety-Ackety!" cried some of the children. "Clumper-Dumper!" cried the others.
They shouted and shrieked, and only the fir tree stood in silence and thought, "Won't I get to take part?
Won't I get to do anything?"
It had been part of the celebration, after all. It had done what it was supposed to do. And then the man told the story of Clumper Dumper, who fell down the stairs but still ended up on the throne and won the hand of the princess. And the children clapped their hands and shouted,
"Tell us more! Tell us more!"
They wanted to hear the one about Ickity-Ackity, too, but he would only tell them the story about Clumper Dumper. The fir tree stood quite still and pensive. The birds in the forest had never mentioned anything like this. Clumper Dumper fell down the stairs and yet won the hand of the princess. Well, well, so that's the way the things are out in the world, thought the fir tree, believing that it was all true because such a nice man had told the story. Well, well, who knows? Maybe I too will fall down the stairs and win the princess. And the fir tree looked forward to the next day, when it would be adorned with candles and toys, gold and fruit.
"Tomorrow I won't tremble," it thought. "I will fully enjoy all my glory. Tomorrow I'll hear the story about Clumper Dumper again, and maybe the one about Ickity-Ackity too."
And the tree stood still and pensive all night long. In the morning a servant and a maid came into the room.
"Now the finery is going to start again," thought the tree.
But they dragged it out of the parlour and up the stairs to the attic. And there, in a dark corner where no daylight shone, they left it.
"What does this mean?" thought the tree. "I wonder what I'm supposed to do here. I wonder what I'm going to hear now."
It leaned against the wall and stood there thinking and thinking. And it had plenty of time for that, because day after day and night after night went by. No one came up to the attic, and when someone finally did, it was only to put some large boxes in the corner. The tree stood quite hidden. You would almost think it had been completely forgotten.
"Now it's winter outside," thought the tree. "The ground is hard and covered with snow. The people wouldn't be able to plant me. No doubt that's why I'm standing here, safe indoors until springtime. What a good plan! How kind the people are! If only it wasn't so dark in here, and so terribly lonely. There's not even a little hare. It was so nice out there in the forest when the snow lay on the ground and the hare came running past. Yes, even when it leapt right over me, although I didn't like it much at the time. But up here it's terribly lonely."
"Squeak, squeak," said a little mouse at that very moment and came scurrying.
And then another little mouse appeared. They sniffed at the fir tree and scurried in and out of its branches.
"It's awfully cold," said the little mice, "but otherwise it's quite blissful to be here. Don't you agree, you old fir tree?"
"I'm not old at all," said the fir tree. "There are plenty of trees that are much older than I am."
"Where did you come from?" asked the mice. "And what do you know?"
They were awfully curious.
"Tell us about the loveliest place on earth. Have you ever been there? Have you been in the pantry where cheeses are lined up on the shelves and hams hung from the ceiling? Where you can dance on tallow candles? Where you go in skinny but come out fat?"
"I don't know that place," said the tree. "But I do know the forest, where the sun shines and the birds sing."
And then the tree told them all about its youth, and the little mice had never heard anything like that before. They listened closely and said,
"Oh, you've seen so much. How happy you've been."
"Me?"
said the fir tree, thinking about everything it had just described.
"Why, yes, I suppose those were quite delightful days after all."
But then the tree told them about Christmas Eve, when it was decorated with cakes and candles.
"Oh," said the little mice, "how happy you've been, you old fir tree."
"I'm not old at all," said the tree. "It was only this winter that I came here from the forest. I'm in the prime of my life. I've just stopped growing."
"How wonderfully you describe things," said the little mice.
And the following night they brought along four other little mice who wanted to hear what the tree had to tell. And the more the tree told them, the more clearly it remembered everything, and thought,
"Those actually were quite enjoyable days. But they can come again, they can come again. Clumper Dumper fell down the stairs, yet he won the hand of the princess. Maybe I too can win a princess."
And then the fir tree thought about a charming little birch tree that grew out in the forest. For the fir tree, the birch was a real and lovely princess.
"Who's Clumper Dumper?"
asked the little mice. And then the fir tree told them the whole story. It could remember every single word. And the little mice were ready to run all the way to the top of the tree out of sheer glee. The next night many more mice came, and on Sunday there were even 2 rats. But they said the story wasn't amusing, and that made the little mice sad, because then they thought less of the story themselves.
"Is that the only story you know?"
asked the rats. "The only one," replied the tree. "I heard it on the happiest evening of my life. But back then I didn't realize how happy I was."
"It's an exceptionally tedious story. Don't you know any about bacon and tallow candles? Any pantry stories?"
"No," said the tree.
"Well, thanks for nothing," replied the rats,
and they went back home. Eventually the little mice disappeared too, and then the tree sighed. It was so nice having those nimble little mice sitting around me and listening to what I told them. Now that, too, is over. But I'm going to remember to enjoy myself when they finally take me out of here. But when would that happen? Well, one day in the early morning, servants came up to the attic and started rummaging around. The boxes were moved aside, and the tree was pulled out. Now, it's true that they threw it to the floor rather hard, but then a man dragged it at once toward the stairs, where daylight was shining. "Now life will begin again," thought the tree. It could feel the fresh air, the first rays of sun, and then it was out in the courtyard. Everything happened so fast that the tree forgot all about taking a look at itself. There was so much to see all around. The courtyard was next to a garden, and everything was in bloom. The roses hung so fresh and fragrant over the little fence, the linden trees were blossoming, and the swallows flew about saying, "Kirivirivit, my husband has arrived." But it wasn't the fir tree they meant. "Now I'm going to live," rejoiced the tree, spreading its branches wide. But alas, its boughs were all withered and yellow. In the corner, among the weeds and nettles, was where the tree came to rest. The star made from gold paper was still on its top, shimmering in the bright sunshine. In the courtyard, several of the lively children were playing who had danced around the tree at Christmas time, taking such delight in it. One of the youngest children came over and tore off the golden star.
"Look what's still sitting on the horrid old Christmas tree," he said,
stomping on the branches so they groaned under his boots. And the tree looked at all that floral splendour and freshness in the garden. Then it looked at itself, and wished that it had stayed in the dark corner of the attic. The tree thought about its fresh youth in the forest, about the joyous Christmas Eve, and about the little mice who had listened so happily to the story about Clumper Dumper.
"It's over. It's over," said the poor tree. "If only I had enjoyed it while I could. It's over. It's over."
And the hired man came over and chopped the tree into little pieces. It made a whole stack. How lovely the tree flared up under the big copper cauldron, and it sighed so deeply, each sigh was like the sound of a little shot. That's why the children who were playing came running over and sat down in front of the fire, staring into the flames and shouting, "Bang! Snap!" But with each sharp crack, which was a deep sigh, the tree thought about a summer day in the forest, or about a winter night out there when the stars were shining. It thought about Christmas Eve, and about Clumper Dumper, the only story it had ever heard and knew how to tell. And before long the tree had burned up. The boys played in the courtyard, and on his chest the youngest one had the gold star that the tree had worn on its happiest evening. Now it was over, and the tree was gone, along with the story. It was over. Over. And that's what happens to every story.
The Snow Queen, A Tale in 7 Stories. First story, which is about the mirror and its pieces. All right, now let's begin. When we reach the end of the story, we'll know more than we know now, because there was an evil troll. He was one of the very worst. He was the devil. One day he was in a truly good mood because he had created a mirror that had the power to make everything good and beautiful that was reflected in it shrink to almost nothing, while whatever was worthless and loathsome would stand out clearly and look even worse. In the mirror, the loveliest landscape looked like boiled spinach, and the best people turned beastly or stood on their heads with no stomachs. Their faces became so distorted that they were beyond recognition. And if you had a freckle, you could be sure that it would spread over your nose and mouth. That was excellent fun, said the devil. If a good pious thought passed through someone's mind, a smirk would appear in the mirror, and the troll demon would have to laugh at his ingenious invention. Everyone who attended troll school, because he ran a troll school, told everyone else that a miracle had occurred. For the first time, they said, it was possible to see how the world and human beings actually looked. They ran around with the mirror, and in the end there wasn't a country or a person that hadn't been distorted by it. Then they even wanted to fly up to heaven itself to ridicule the angels and our Lord. The higher they flew with the mirror, the more it smirked. They could hardly hold on to it. Higher and higher they flew, closer to God and the angels. Then the mirror began trembling so terribly as it smirked that it flew out of their hands and plummeted to earth, where it broke into 100 million billion pieces and more. And that was precisely the reason why it did even more harm than before, because some of the pieces were hardly bigger than a grain of sand. They flew around in the wide world, and whenever they landed in someone's eye, that's where they would stay. Then those people would see everything wrong, or only have eyes for what was bad in something, since every little speck of mirror had kept the same powers that the whole mirror possessed. Some people even got a little piece of mirror in their heart, and then it was quite dreadful. The heart would turn into a lump of ice. Some pieces of mirror were so big that they were used for window panes, but it wasn't worth looking through those panes to see your friends. Other pieces ended up in eyeglasses, and then things would go badly when people put on the glasses to see properly and fairly. The evil one laughed until his belly split. It tickled him so splendidly. But outside, little pieces of glass were still flying around in the air. Now let's hear what happened. Second story, A Little Boy and a Little Girl. In the big city, where there are so many buildings and people that there isn't enough room for everyone to have a little garden, and where most people have to be content with flowers in pots, there were two poor children who did have a garden that was slightly bigger than a flower pot. They were not brother and sister, yet they were as fond of each other as if they had been. Their families lived right next door to each other. They lived in two garret rooms. At the place where the roof of one building touched the roof of the other and the gutter ran along the eaves, a little window jutted out from each building. All you had to do was step over the gutter to go from one window to the other. Outside, each family had a big wooden box, and in it grew herbs for cooking and a little rose bush. There was one in each box. They grew so wondrously. Then their parents decided to set the boxes atop the gutter, so they almost reached from one window to the other and looked exactly like two flower beds. Pea vines hung down the sides of the boxes, and the rose bushes sprouted long branches that twined around the windows and bent toward each other. It was almost like a triumphal arch of greenery and blossoms. Since the boxes were quite high, and the children knew that they weren't supposed to crawl out, they were often allowed to climb out the windows to each other and sit on their little stools beneath the roses. That's where they played so happily. In the winter, of course, that amusement would come to an end. The windows were often completely frosted over, but then they would heat up copper skillings on the stove, place the hot skillings on the frozen window pane, and then a lovely peephole would appear, so round. So round. Through it a blessed gentle eye would peek, one in each window. It was the little boy and the little girl. His name was Kai, and hers was Gerda. In the summer they could reach each other with a single bound. In the winter they first had to go down all those stairs, and then up all those other stairs. Outside the snow swirled in drifts. The white bees are swarming, said old grandmother. "Do they have a queen bee too?" asked the little boy, because he knew that real bees had one. "Yes, they do," said Grandmother. "She flies in the thick of the swarm. She's the biggest of them all, and she never rests on the ground. She flies up at once inside the black cloud. Many a winter night she flies through the city streets, peering in the windows, and then they frost over so strangely, looking like flowers." "Oh, yes, we've seen that," said both children, so they knew it must be true. "Can the Snow Queen come inside?" asked the little girl. "Just let her come," said the boy, "and I'll put her on the hot stove and then she'll melt." But Grandmother stroked his hair and told them other stories. One evening, when little Kai was home and almost undressed, he climbed up onto the chair by the window and peeked out the little hole. A few snowflakes were falling outside, and one of them, the biggest of all, remained lying on the edge of one of the flower boxes. The snowflake grew bigger and bigger, until it became at last a whole woman, dressed in the sheerest white gossamer, which looked as if it were made of millions of star-like flakes. She was so beautiful and elegant, but made of ice, dazzling, glittering ice, and yet she was alive. Her eyes stared like two bright stars, but there was nothing calm or peaceful about them. She nodded at the window and waved her hand. The little boy was terrified and jumped down from the chair. Then it seemed as if a huge bird flew past the window outside. The next day was bright and cold, and then came spring. The sun shone, green sprouts appeared, the swallows built their nests, the windows were flung open, and the little children once again sat in their tiny garden high up in the eaves, at the very top of the buildings. That summer the roses bloomed so marvellously. The little girl had learned a hymn that spoke of roses, and those roses made her think of her own. She sang it for the little boy, and he sang along. "In the valley where roses grow wild, there will we speak to the Christ child." And the children held each other's hands, kissed the roses, and looked into God's bright sunshine, speaking to it as if the Christ child were there. How lovely the summer days were! How heavenly to be outside near the fresh rose bushes that never seemed to stop blooming! Kai and Gerda sat looking at a picture book with animals and birds. That was when, just as the clock struck 5 on the big church tower, Kai said, "Ow! Something stabbed me in the heart, and now I have something in my eye." The little girl put her arm around his neck. He blinked his eyes. No, there was nothing to be seen. "I think it's gone," he said. But it was not gone. It was one of those specks of glass that came from the mirror, the troll mirror. Of course we remember it, the horrid glass that made everything great and good that was reflected in it become small and hideous, while the evil and wicked appeared quite clearly, and every fault that anything possessed was noticed at once. Poor Kai, he had also gotten a speck right in the heart, which would soon turn into a lump of ice. At the moment it didn't hurt, but it was there. "Why are you crying?" he asked. "It makes you look so horrid. There's nothing wrong with me." "Ugh!" he suddenly shouted. "That rose over there has been gnawed by a worm. And look, that one is completely crooked. These roses are actually quite disgusting. They look like the boxes they're standing in." And then he kicked the box hard with his foot and tore off 2 of the roses. "Kai, what are you doing?" cried the little girl. And when he saw her horror, he tore off another rose and then dashed through his window, away from blessed little Gerda. Later, when she brought out the picture book, he said that it was for babies, and if Grandmother told them stories, he would always come with some objection. Whenever he had the chance, he would walk behind her, putting on glasses and talking the way she did. It was a perfect likeness, and then people would laugh at him. Soon he could walk and talk like everyone on the whole street. Everything that was odd about them and unattractive, Kai could imitate. Then people said, "He certainly has a clever head on his shoulders, that boy." But it was the glass that had landed in his eye and the glass that sat in his heart. They were the reason he teased even little Gerda, who loved him with all her soul. The games he played were now very different from before. They were so logical. One winter day, as the snowflakes swirled in drifts, he brought out a big magnifying glass, held out a corner of his blue coat, and let the flakes land on it. "Look into the glass, Gerda," he said, and every snowflake grew much bigger, looking like a magnificent flower or a 10-pointed star. It was lovely to see. "Do you see how ingenious they are?" said Kai. "They're much more interesting than real flowers, and none of them has a single flaw. They're quite perfect, as long as they don't melt." A little while later, Kai appeared wearing big gloves and carrying his sled on his back. He shouted right into Gerda's ear, "I have permission to go sledding at the big square where the others are playing," and off he went. Over in the square, the most daring of the boys would often tie their sleds to the farmer's wagon, and then they would ride along for a good stretch down the road. They were having a merry time. In the midst of their games, a huge sleigh appeared. It was painted all white, and in it sat someone swathed in a shaggy white fur and wearing a shaggy white cap. The sleigh circled the square twice, and Kai quickly tied his little sled to it, and then he was riding along. The sleigh went faster and faster right into the next street. The person who was driving turned around and nodded in such a friendly way at Kai, as if they knew each other. Each time Kai tried to untie his little sled, the person would nod again, and then Kai stayed where he was. They drove right out through the city gates. Then the snow began to come down so heavily that the little boy couldn't even see his hand in front of him, but he kept racing along. He hastily let go of the rope to get away from the huge sleigh, but it did no good. His little sled hung on, moving with the speed of the wind. Then he shouted quite loudly, but no one heard him. The snow swirled in drifts, and the sleigh sped along. Once in a while it would give a hop, as if flying over ditches and fences. Kai was quite terrified. He wanted to say the Lord's Prayer, but all he could remember was his multiplication tables. The snowflakes grew bigger and bigger, until at last they looked like big white hens. Suddenly they leaped aside, the huge sleigh came to a halt, and the person who was driving it stood up. The fur coat and cap were nothing but snow. It was a woman, standing so tall and straight, so shimmering white. It was the Snow Queen. "We've made good progress," she said. "But aren't you freezing? Crawl in under my bearskin." And she set him in the sleigh beside her, wrapping the bearskin around him. He felt as if he were sinking into a snowdrift. "Are you still freezing?" she asked, and then she kissed him on the forehead. Ooh! It was colder than ice. It went right to his heart, which was already half ice. He felt as if he would die, but only for a moment, and then he felt fine. He no longer noticed the cold all around him. "My sled! Don't forget my sled!" That was the first thing he thought of, and so it was tied onto one of the white hens, which flew along behind with the sled on its back. The Snow Queen kissed Kai again, and then he forgot all about little Gerda and grandmother and everyone else back home. "No more kisses for you," she said, "or I might kiss you to death." Kai looked at her. She was so beautiful. He couldn't imagine a wiser or lovelier face. She no longer seemed made of ice, as she had when she sat outside the window and beckoned to him. To his eyes, she now seemed perfect. He was not the least bit afraid. He told her that he could do his figures in his head, even with fractions, or how many square miles each country had, and how many inhabitants, and she kept on smiling. Then he thought that what he knew was not nearly enough. He looked up at the vast, vast sky, and she flew along with him, flew high up into the black cloud, and the storm rumbled and roared, as if it were singing ancient ballads. They flew over forests and lakes, over sea and land. Beneath them rushed the cold wind. The wolves howled, the snow sparkled, and over it flew shrieking black crows. But up above, the moon glowed big and bright, and Kai gazed at it all night, that long, long winter night. In the daytime he slept at the Snow Queen's feet. Third story. The Flower Garden of the Woman Who Knew Magic. But how did little Gerda feel when Kai didn't come back? Where was he? No one knew. No one could tell her. The boys said only that they had seen him tie his little sled to a magnificent huge sleigh that drove down the street and out the city gates. No one knew where he was. Many tears fell. Little Gerda wept so hard and so long. Then they said that he was dead. He had drowned in the river that ran close to the city. Oh, those were such long and dark winter days. Then came spring with warmer sunshine. Kai is dead and gone, said little Gerda. I don't believe it, said the sunshine. He's dead and gone, she told the swallows. We don't believe it, they replied. And in the end, Gerda didn't believe it either. I'll put on my new red shoes, she said one morning. Kai has never seen them. And then I'll go down to the river and ask about him. It was very early. She kissed old grandmother who was sleeping, put on her red shoes, and walked all alone out the gates to the river. Is it true that you've taken my little playmate? I'll give you my red shoes if you'll give him back to me. And it seemed to her that the waves nodded quite strangely. Then she picked up her red shoes, her dearest possessions, and threw both of them into the river. But they fell close to shore, and the little waves promptly brought them back to her on land, as if the river didn't want to take her dearest possessions, since it didn't have little Kai. But she thought that she hadn't thrown them far enough, and so she climbed into a boat that was floating among the reeds. She went all the way out to the farthest end and threw the shoes, but the boat wasn't tied securely, and with her movement it glided away from land. She noticed this and hurried to get out, but before she could make her way back, the boat was more than 2 feet from shore, and it began to slip away even faster. Then little Gerda grew quite frightened and started to cry, but no one heard her except the sparrows. They couldn't carry her back to land, but they flew along the shore and sang, as if to comfort her, "Here we are, here we are." The boat drifted with the current, and little Gerda sat quite still in her stocking feet. Her little red shoes floated along behind, but they couldn't reach the boat. It was picking up speed. It was beautiful on both banks, with lovely flowers, old trees, and sheep and cows on the slopes, but not a person in sight. Maybe the river will take me to little Kai, thought Gerda, and then her spirits rose. She stood up and for many hours looked at the beautiful green banks. Then she came to a big cherry orchard. There stood a little house that had strange red and blue windows, as well as a thatched roof. Outside stood 2 wooden soldiers who presented arms for all who sailed past. Gerda called to them. She thought they were alive, but of course they didn't answer. She came quite close to them, and the river lifted the boat toward land. Gerda shouted even louder, and then out of the house came an old, old woman leaning on a crooked stick. She was wearing a big sun hat that was painted with the loveliest flowers.
"You poor little child," said the old woman. "How did you end up in the big strong current, drifting far out in the wide world?"
And then the old woman came right out into the water, hooked her crooked stick on the boat, pulled it ashore, and lifted out little Gerda. Gerda was glad to be on dry land, yet she was a little afraid of the strange old woman.
"Come here and tell me who you are and how you happened to get here," she said.
Gerda told her everything, and the old woman shook her head and said,
"My, my."
After Gerda had told her everything and asked whether she had seen little Kai, the woman said that he had not come past, but no doubt he would. She shouldn't be so sad, but have a taste of her cherries and look at her flowers. They were more beautiful than any picture book. Each of them could tell a whole story. Then she took Gerda by the hand. They went inside the little house, and the old woman locked the door. The windows were high up, with panes that were red, blue, and yellow. The daylight shone so strangely inside from all those colours. On the table were the loveliest cherries, and Gerda ate as many as she liked, because she was no longer afraid. While she ate, the old woman combed her hair with a golden comb, and her hair curled and gleamed such a lovely yellow all around her cheerful little face, which was so round and looked like a rose.
"Oh, how I've longed for such a sweet little girl," said the old woman. "Now you'll see how well the two of us will get along."
And as she combed little Gerda's hair, Gerda forgot more and more about Kai, who was like a brother, because the old woman knew magic, although she was not a bad witch. She merely did a little conjuring for her own amusement, and now she wanted to keep little Gerda. That's why she went into the garden, stretched out her crooked stick toward all the rose bushes, and no matter how lovely their blossoms, every one of them sank into the black earth. It was impossible to tell where they had stood. The old woman was afraid that when Gerda saw the roses, she would think about her own, remember little Kai, and run off. Then she led Gerda out to the flower garden.
Oh, what a fragrance! What loveliness there was! Every imaginable flower from every season of the year stood there in full bloom. No picture book could be more colourful or beautiful. Gerda jumped for joy and played until the sun went down behind the tall cherry trees. Then she was given a lovely bed with red silk comforters filled with blue violets, and she slept and dreamed as blissfully as any queen on her wedding day. The next day she played again with the flowers in the warm sunshine. In that manner many days passed. Gerda knew every flower, but no matter how many there were, she still thought that one must be missing, though she didn't know which it might be. Then one day she was sitting and looking at the old woman's sun hat with the painted flowers, and the most beautiful of all was a rose. The old woman had forgotten to remove it from her hat when she put the others into the ground. That's what happens when you don't have your wits about you.
What? Said Gerda. Aren't there any roses here? And she leaped among the flower beds, searching and searching, but there was not one to be found. Then she sat down and wept, but her hot tears fell on the very spot where a rose bush had vanished. When the hot tears watered the earth, the bush suddenly shot up, as full of blossoms as when it sank. Gerda embraced the bush, kissed the roses, and thought about the lovely roses back home, and then about little Kai.
"Oh, how long I've lingered," said the little girl. "I was supposed to find Kai."
"Do any of you know where he is?" she asked the roses. "Do you think he's dead and gone?"
"Well, he's not dead," said the roses. "We've been in the ground where all the dead are, but Kai wasn't there."
"Oh, thank you," said little Gerda, and she went over to the other flowers and looked inside their chalices and asked, "Do you know where little Kai is?"
But each flower stood in the sun, dreaming of its own tale or story. Little Gerda heard so many of them, but no one knew anything about Kai. What did the fire lily say?
"Do you hear the drum? Bum, bum. It has only two beats, always bum, bum. Listen to the women's mournful song. Listen to the shouts of the priests. In her long red gown the Hindu woman stands on the pyre. The flames leap up around her and her dead husband. But the Hindu woman is thinking of the man who is alive here in the crowd, the man whose eyes burn hotter than flames, the man whose fiery eyes reach deeper into her heart than the blaze that will soon burn her body to ashes. Can the flame of the heart die in the flames of the pyre?"
"I don't understand that at all," said little Gerda.
"That's my tale," said the fire lily.
"What does the morning glory say?"
"Above the narrow mountain road perches an old baronial castle. The dense periwinkles twine around the ancient red walls, leaf upon leaf, over to the balcony. That's where a lovely girl stands. She is bending over the railing and gazing down the road. No rose hangs fresher from its branch than she. No apple blossom, when the wind lifts it from the tree, floats lighter than she. How her magnificent silk gown rustles!
Will he never come? Is Kai the one you mean? Asked little Gerda. I'm only telling you my tale, my dream, replied the Morning Glory.
What does the little Snowdrop say?
Between the trees, a long board hangs from ropes. It's a swing. Two charming little girls, their dresses as white as snow, long green silk ribbons fluttering from their hats, are sitting there, swinging. Their brother, who is bigger than they are, is standing on the swing. He has one arm hooked around the rope to hold on, because in one hand he has a little bowl, in the other a clay pipe. He's blowing soap bubbles. The swing sways, the bubbles fly with lovely shifting colours. The last one is still clinging to the stem of the pipe, quivering in the wind. The swing sways. The little black dog, as light as the bubbles, stands on his hind legs to get up on the swing. The swing flies. The dog falls, barking and angry. They're teasing him. The bubbles burst. A swinging board, a leaping froth picture. That is my song.
Your story may well be a beautiful one, but you tell it so mournfully, and you don't mention